Welcome to the Donnybrook Podcast. I'm your host, David.
I'm Amanda.
And this is John, and I have a question.
All right. What's your question?
Okay, so here's the question. As I was driving around the fall colors of Boise today, this is the random thought that jumped into my head. So generally speaking, most Christians at this point don't have much of an issue with like tattoos. For the most part, you're going to find some older people maybe that still hold to a note that that there's a biblical mandate against mm-hmm. tattoos. And I would say, to a lesser extent, there has been a huge relaxation on the issue of alcohol and drinking, especially in conservative circles, mm-hmm. And the understanding of what is permissible there. So here's my question. Is explicit or obscene language the next thing to fall, or is this going to be a stickier wicket? And I'm asking the question because I have had I feel like I could trace it back to Mark Driscoll and the cursing pastor, who would get up and he would, in really, really strong, strongly worded, strongly stated things, he would actually use four-letter language to drive home points from the pulpit from time to time. And then we've seen Christian hip-hop artists here begin to use curse words. I've heard a number of older men who I have a high regard for slip some D's and some H's into language that we're just having some conversation mm-hmm. Along the,
just kind of slip into
casual conversation. And I'm like, what? And I've done a little bit of a double take because these are people that 10 or 15 years ago, I don't feel like I would have ever heard a casual slip up. And
but is that just because they got older and they just didn't care anymore? Like,
wouldn't you say they went Clint Eastwood on everybody?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know. I'm posing the question to you guys. And what is your? I don't think that there are magic combinations of letters or vowels or sounds that make words intrinsically good or evil. So I think that's when we were in Thailand. There was the word for pumpkin was. Basically F you. That was that's the nicest. I can tell you exactly what it sounded like. And it's so close that when we heard it the first time, Melissa and I both swiveled our heads around, went, what are you teaching our kids? But that's obviously that's not sinful in and of itself. So what is your guys' take on that? Is this the next thing to fall? We first had tattoos, alcohol. Are we going to have pastors swearing from the pulpit? And will casual cursing be normative? I want to put that caveat on there, the casual kind of conversational use of explicit language. Go.
Interesting.
What do you think, David?
Very interesting.
David, do you use curse words in your casual conversation? We'll make it really pointed.
I don't.
Why
I
don't. Not?
I feel like it is not helpful.
Pansy.
And I feel like if I started to use curse words in my casual conversation, I would not be able to control it.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
So
that is interesting.
Like, I feel like it's much better to be 100%, I guess, authentic everywhere I go, so that I don't have to remember the context that I'm in to...
Anything you're okay with, you need to be okay with in all contexts.
Yes. So think about a radio host who is on the air for 3 hours a day. That's a lot of talking, and if you're on the air for 3 hours a day, when you're in radio mode, you gotta like watch your language, but maybe you don't watch your language when you're, having a casual evening.
We invented the 5 second delay for this.
This is exactly
reason.
Right. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So it causes like a lot of. I think it would cause a lot of stress. I think it's a lot easier to just say, no, those words are not part of my vocabulary.
Okay, and I respect what you're saying, but I feel like a lot of people have made the same argument about alcohol. Okay, that's fine. That's good for you, but
Well, also, I'm betting more than a little of this is you just have no desire to use curse words.
Agreed.
Much like you have no desire to drink alcohol.
Agreed as well. Right?
It tastes bad. You don't like it. So why do it?
Exactly. I'm not going to like do a lot of work to try to learn how to enjoy alcohol when I don't really see that there's any intrinsic value for me.
And same for swearing. You don't see any need to have swear words in your vocabulary. So there's no reason to develop the habit that you're just going to have to exercise self-control over.
Yes. Yes. Yes.
Okay. Well, nice. That's not emphatic.
Like I think, yeah.
No, I probably, like the thought progression in the tone.
Yes. Oh, definitely yes.
Yeah. Don't say that English is not a tonal language. Yeah. You just made it tonal. Totally. That's awesome. Okay, so Amanda, I know you have a different persuasion on this.
I do.
And maybe it's an evolving persuasion.
Well, I don't know about evolving. Like, I'm comfortable using certain crude language in certain contexts, and I will. I don't have strong convictions about not using particular words. I do have a very strong conviction that there is one thing that I can't do, and that's to take the Lord's name in vain. Like, to be casual about God's name in really any sense is just, that's clearly forbidden by the scripture. There are definitely times that I find forceful language appropriate to express what I have to say about a particular thing. And I'm not uncomfortable with that. I don't feel any guilt about that, or feel like I'm pushing a boundary there. Obviously, I'm careful not to use that language in contexts where it might be considered inappropriate or might be inappropriate. I wouldn't use strong language in front of children, and I wouldn't use it just to...
How do you define children? Sorry, continue.
what about in front of your children? Or would that depend
on the context?
No,
I don't swear in front of my children.
Would that depend on the context?
No, I don't swear in front of my children.
What if you needed to get something forceful across to them?
I wouldn't use it to
okay.
them.
Okay, they're, but they're we've kids. Gotten away from the question. So the question is, do you think...
Yeah.
So we've got our personal... You guys have put your personal... I appreciate that. So do you think do you think this is the next thing to fall in the...
Shifting cultural,
the shifting fundamentalist Christianity to, because I feel like I'm seeing this within conservative circles, the move away from tattoo.
I think the thing to then question or to think about is, what is the shift away from strong convictions about tattoos, or the shift away from strong, anti-alcohol stance about? Why has that strong anti-alcohol stance been so up for revision in this generation? And why is the tattoo question been so up for revision? If we're going to talk about swearing in that same context, we got to know why that's been happening.
Well, I can just give a 30-second, then you guys, if you accept this, then we'll continue the conversation. If you reject it, then we're just going to ground it, and so we can get on with the podcast. But I think in general, our generation has looked at that there were certain cultural norms that tattoos and drinking were associated with that were such negative behaviors that for the most part, people who got tattoos were people who were engaging in other negative behavior, people who were drinking this one's a little more nuanced, but people who are drinking large amounts of alcohol
to excess.
Exactly. There was an idea that the only reason you drank was to get drunk and to be out of control. And so there was an association with those things that was purely negative and rebellious and sin, like interested in sinning as recreation. Mm-hmm. And I think we could lump explicit or obscene language into that same general cultural conversation. And I think this generation has generally looked at tattoos and said there's not a lot of scriptural basis for a full-blown, full-blown yes or no black and white conversation about the tattoos. There's not a lot of scriptural basis for that, for the conversation on alcohol. I think there's a better scriptural basis for obscene or profane language, certainly, but then there's some gray there.
Well,
so
yeah, I mean, you look at the Bible. I mean, Jesus himself used some pretty sharp language, and so did Paul in places. There's
that in cultural context would count as obscene or profane language.
Yeah, to make a point about how bad something was. Mm-hmm. So it's not that the Bible is exactly saying, no, you can't.
Well, I would say obscene, not profane. Okay.
That's a good distinction.
Yeah. So better precision. If we look at the, I think if we look at kind of a new, I'm thinking about like kind of celebrity pastors with tattoos all over and ripped jeans and the cool guy. I think that's a certain kind of audience, I guess, that's being catered to. I don't know if catered is the right word.
So is that a yes or no? Yes, you expect.
I'm thinking.
Well, yes. While you're thinking, yes. I want to yes. agree with John's assessment of what happened with drinking and tattoos, and just maybe phrase it slightly differently, that there's been a strong pushback against legalistic sure. rules.
Yeah.
And so I think that there's less room in this. I agree that there's less room in the swearing conversation for just reappropriating swearing for Christianity, because it's usefulness, or it's not wine that gladdens the heart. Mm. I think that the cases where it's appropriate are extremely limited. Even though I don't have a problem using it,
sure,
it's only appropriate in very particular cases and contexts. And even then, it may not ever be necessary. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think the pushback is against legalism in a lot of ways.
Right. And I think we're moving from where people are saying, how can I still take a faithful reading and understanding of scripture without being fundamentalist,
mm-hmm.
without, mm-hmm. or Pharisaical or legalist.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I think pushback against an association of Christianity with niceness, nice 1950s, neat society looks nice kind mm-hmm. of manners approach to rules for behavior
mm-hmm.
And trying to push back on that and really ask what the scripture expects of us.
Okay. So David, I'm sorry, go ahead.
So let's just look at the heart for a moment. And I think
mine or yours?
The church's heart in general.
Oh, okay.
So if tattoos are being used as a way to express your individuality in a thoughtful and
artistically expensive way.
Sure, exactly. And not a rebellious and angry and profane way. I think that that's something that the modern Christian sensibilities would say, that's okay. And I think to the same thing we'd say with alcohol. Same thing, you know, we're not drinking to excess. We're drinking to gladden the heart. That's okay. And I think we could probably look at swearing in the same way. Why are you swearing?
So I would argue that point. I don't think you can look at swearing in the same way.
Hmm. Interesting. So you think you can't? You think swearing?
So I think there are three separate things. I think that the rebellion against or the pushback on all three of those categories is coming from the same place. But I think there are actually three. I would separate them out and not categorically put them in the same general. Area. So I think tattoos, I think there's so little scriptural basis for a, what's the word I'm looking for? For an ultimatum against tattoos, a ban on tattoos. Mm-hmm. I think there's so little scriptural basis for it that it's not a black and white issue. It's not a gray issue. It's not a moral issue at all, period, dot, the end. I mean, that's how that... Yeah. So in one sense,
here feeling grateful as the swearing, beer drinking, and only... tattooed member of this group.
Yeah, but your tattoo doesn't count.
Oh, okay.
Your tattoo, you're only, unless I'm, no. unless there's a tattoo I don't know about. unless you have a stamp tramp somewhere that.
Please, no. No, I just have the one, the ring. Okay.
So I don't think that tattoo, for the listening audience, Amanda, you better reference which one
you have. I have a wedding ring tattooed on my finger. So
right. Yeah. So listening audience, that can go on our poll. Does that actually count as a tattoo?
For some people, it might.
Right, for the really hard line.
I think I
line.
Probably have a late great-grandmother or two who would have been horrified by
right,
it.
Right, right. Hardliners maybe, but for the most part, I think people, when they hear tattoo, they're thinking sleeve, they're thinking something visual.
I've gotten zero flack for my tattoo in my life, and I think that's reasonable. It's fairly sweet and innocent, and yes. Right.
So I think there's almost no scriptural basis one way or the other for tattoos. So I almost dismiss that as even a real conversation, like a real debate. Alcohol, on the other hand, there is real debate because people die from drunk drivers. But they're everything in moderation. So that is a different discussion entirely, where it certainly is permissible. And I kind of apply the food sacrifice to idols part of 1 Corinthians mm-hmm. to that whole discussion, where the way we handle alcohol should be determined on the basis of the weaker brother who is among us and otherwise our conscience. As long as we're working within the context of not drinking in excess, it's a conscience thing. It's an individual choice. The other issue, though, I feel like is with explicit language or the benefit of that language and then the variations of the language make it tricky for me. Mm-hmm. So there's so many words. Mm-hmm. And so I have had to catch myself. I am really, really prone to use. Have you guys ever seen the skit Shoot Christians Say?
No.
That's great.
It's done by, he's a Christian. See, I just did it. Christian comedian, and he kind of pokes fun at the four-letter words that Christians are allowed to use. Mm-hmm. And I'm really prone to that. I find myself using four-letter
equivalencies
a lot. And it's really easy. It would be really easy for, like you said, to slip into using just the explicit language as a commonplace way of expressing myself, because I am a person who likes hyperbole. I like to take things to zero mm-hmm. to 100.
Yep.
And so...
And strong language gets you there.
And strong language helps with that, yeah.
Yeah.
So the benefit of it is questionable in my mind. It's a very layered conversation, and my concern, so if I just lay my cards on the table, I think that's where we're moving, and I think people are going to justify it under the same terms. I don't think it's the same conversation.
And you don't think it's good? You think it would not be a good witness for Christians to start dropping F-bombs because it's cool?
Well, right. I think what it sounded to me like, you think it's concerning to justify one behavior under the reasoning for a different category, mm-hmm. right? Like we're loosening legalism, therefore we can let go of our standards on this. And there are, and I think it's very fair, there are much stronger scriptural support for being very, very careful about your language than there is for
right.
not having any wine. Much stronger.
Right. So I'm less worried about the person who uses HE-double hockey sticks in their day-to-day conversation than the person who is constantly demeaning towards other people, saying, the casual road rage driver who's always calling people idiots and morons and just using incredibly demeaning language,
Rocker.
Whether in their towards other drivers, towards mm-hmm. their children, towards their spouse,
towards Siri.
I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of people who have had interactions with where they're scarred from their parents because their parents said something. They ask them to go get a tool or something, and they come back with the wrong tool, and they say, "Are you an idiot? I asked for this and you brought me that." That kind of language.
I thought we were done revisiting my childhood.
Real life.
I wasn't talking about you.
But I think
if the shoe fits.
I think that so this is something I said earlier, that I have a really strong conviction against using the Lord's name in vain, and I didn't think of it in the moment, but
I would call it profane. That's why I made this.
Which, yeah. Absolutely right. I do also have very strong convictions about not directing harsh or demeaning language against other people. So that if I'm using strong language to make a point, I'm not using strong language to describe or imprecate. Someone. You don't direct swear words at someone, and you don't, and not just swear words, but like, you know, use idiot or moron.
Right.
Like that's assaulting the image of God.
Right. And I think I feel the same way with the assault on the image of God when we start bringing in body parts and obscene language that is representing.
We all know what you mean.
Yeah. But you follow what I'm saying. Like that also is an assault on the image of God. And I suppose that there could be some context, like you were trying to say, their strong language works for strong situations, but we're getting really close to the shades of dark gray.
Okay.
When we get to those types of words, so I don't know. It's a concern for me.
Yeah,
I feel like we're seeing a casual kind of cursing in our day to day language and I grew up on a farm. Like I don't get uncomfortable when people use curse words around me. In fact, people at my work who know that I serve at a church, they'll curse and then they'll apologize to me. I'm like, man, it's okay. Like I'm talking specifically about the mature Christian believer who is, are we straying into a casual kind of obscene language that is unbefitting the Christian dialogue and the Christian walk. So anyway,
I think that at the beginning of the conversation, I was trying to take up the opposite position from where I thought you were headed, just sort of naturally without even thinking about it.
I have no idea which direction you thought I was headed or which opposite direction you were moving in.
Whatever you just said right there,
okay.
That's what I think.
Okay.
Because that right there is my heart. And to what you said, Amanda, about being respectful, not demeaning the image of God. Mm-hmm. And what did Paul talk about? Putting your emphasis, your focus on good things, on lovely things, on things that are going to build people up. And then thinking about James and what he talks about, taming the tongue and being careful about your words. And because once it's out, you can't take it back.
And I didn't bring this, just for full disclosure, I didn't bring this up because I've ever been uncomfortable with the way you've used language, because you've used stronger language around me before. Mm-hmm. And that's not made me uncomfortable. It's that casual kind of just flippancy. That really makes me uncomfortable. I have another friend who will remain unnamed, but was also an English major as an undergraduate, who's a mature Christian, and he has a different kind of approach to language where he will use stronger language from time to time, and it doesn't make me uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. But I think also he understands like contextually where it's appropriate and where it's inappropriate,
right.
and whatnot. It's not a casual thing. Right. It's an augmentation of speech.
Well, and I think that I want to be careful about not going beyond scripture and restricting something that isn't restricted. I find that that's something I care a lot about. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to using harsh language or strong language, I tend to find it helpful for expressing some of the difficult emotions and the difficult emotional situations that I've had to deal with. And so I wouldn't say for sure, but not all of the time, but most of the time when it comes up in the context of processing trauma.
So we're going to say that. So I think that's a far stronger argument than the two things that I would find tendencies for myself, which would be, I've alluded to this already, but to give it greater clarification. One would be the kind of the flippant, just hyperbole kind of like ramp this thing up a little bit kind of use of the language, which I find just that I am uncomfortable with, and I feel like I'm seeing that more. And then the other one is that profane element, which I think most Christians would agree that's probably an inappropriate use of language.
Right.
The one that I'm very much on the fence on and don't quite know, because it's hard to gauge, is the use of language in humor.
Mm-hmm.
And some things are just funnier. so I mean the story that comes to mind is Balaam's donkey is funnier if we don't call it a donkey.
Yeah.
Because we understand that the real donkey in the situation was not the donkey. Mm-hmm. And that's just funnier if we throw that other language mm-hmm. in there. And Shakespeare understood that, and comedians understand that.
Right.
And that's a slippery slope, and there's a fine line there. That's one where I'm not funny enough to dabble in those waters.
But funny enough to appreciate Shakespeare's play on words.
Right.
So
sometimes it's the double entendres can go too far. And so this is that's the thing with humor. Tension. That's the tension. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you remember earlier this summer, but there was a joke that was made naturally when we were camping about some pugs that came out of my mouth, and I thought it was very funny at the time, but it was very inappropriate. It was very colorful. I'm not even going to repeat it right now.
Oh man, I wish I could remember this.
Yeah, but it was one of those things where it was really funny, and you and Melissa both laughed because it was funny, and in the context it was fine. But I went, okay, that was across the line. I definitely stepped across the line. So
I think that another thing that we really need to take into account is, what is our use of language doing for our witness amongst those that we are on an everyday basis? So when you're at work, when I'm at work with people who are not believers, and
I don't really have that situation at work.
Yeah, shut up. But you do have the Mark Driscoll situation.
I know.
So
Mark Driscoll, that makes me very uncomfortable.
His use of language.
The context in which he's using it. Well, we're not talking about private conversations here or...
Well, I feel like that fell underneath that overextension or that hyperbolic statement and demeaning statements where his statements...
Which fits into a larger pattern.
In his ministry.
Yeah.
So...
Sorry, we cut you off again.
If I'm meeting with a close friend...
We're good at that.
Oh, you know what? Never mind. Amanda and I are going to talk.
If I'm meeting with a close friend who's a believer, a mature believer, and I'm very frustrated about a situation, I think that would be an okay situation to...
Vent.
And I think that's one thing. But if I am with an unbeliever, I need to be careful.
What if you're with your therapist?
That's a good question.
No, the correct answer is my pastor is my therapist. No, I'm just teasing.
Oh my goodness.
But I think that one of the best things, the best witnesses that we have is for all the people that we're with on a daily basis that know what we believe, and they're watching our lives all the time. And whether they say it or not, I mean, the language that we use is a really telling thing, and it's
agreed.
It's really important.
Agreed. And I think that that's especially evident right now in the political season, where we're seeing language being used a lot right now to stir up fear and anger and animosity, and I'm saying that on both sides of the equation. That's not just both sides of partisan politics right now are using language, they're weaponizing language.
We're not even talking about curse words particularly.
No.
We're just talking about
all
kinds of framing of issues in the most inflammatory terms possible.
Right, and the most, inflammatory, and also, I would say in most cases, untruthful and least... benefit of the doubt towards opposing position.
There's no generosity of interpretation.
Anybody who disagrees with my position on this is a complete idiot, moron, and is driving with me at 5 o'clock on the freeway.
Right.
Yeah.
Perhaps they and Balaam's donkey would get along.
Exactly. Exactly.
So
some pugs? I don't know.
Is it Balaam's donkey one of our political figureheads?
So, you know, you mentioned politics, and I wanted to kind of get us sort of moving another direction.
Yeah, here. We just spent half an hour on something we didn't even plan to talk about. So
yeah.
You're welcome.
We're really good at this podcasting thing.
I know. Isn't it fun? I wanted to see what you guys think about the caravan of people that are heading up through Mexico right now.
Stupid, idiotic, dumb.
Well, I want to say like Guatemala, Venezuela. Boy, I think
we're talking about South
America.
Clearly,
we're all
South America.
South yes. Americans.
South America
moving through Mexico currently.
Yes.
Yes.
So, I think it started out as like people heard that there were some people heading up in media, and they said, you know what? I've wanted to go to America too. I'm going to go join this thing. There will be safety in numbers, and it just grew and grew and grew, and now it's thousands of people, and they got to Mexico, and they kept going. Mexico didn't really kind of put the brakes on it. They let them through, and they're headed up to the border right now, hoping to get into the U.S.
Seeking asylum.
Seeking asylum. So I think the question that I have a couple questions. The first question is, what should the U.S. do about it?
That's easy, obviously. That's simple.
That's the first question.
So a softball right over home plate.
My second questions will fall from your answers to that question.
All right, John, what's the easy answer here?
Oh, you want me to answer that question first?
Yeah, it's easy.
The easy answer?
It's easy.
Okay, so I'm gonna give a real answer, and I realize that it's far more complicated than this.
Nuanced.
But it's far more complicated because we've made it complicated, but it doesn't have to be complicated. We have laws. We should follow them. If we don't like them, we should change them, not ignore them. So whatever our immigration policies are, we should adhere to them. If they suck, which they do, we should change them. But we should not arbitrarily change our laws from one administration to the next via executive power or whatever way the wind is blowing to get votes, to rally our party one direction or another, to get Latino votes or to get out overworked, overzealous white votes. The law is the law is the law. And if it isn't good, then change it. So that's the simple answer.
And so the practical interpretation of what you just said is we have immigration laws that allow people to come and seek asylum.
Right.
We should adhere to that process, those asylum seekers, and not try to subvert the asylum seeking process with extraordinary action if we want to revise our asylum seeking immigration laws, then we need to pass new laws through Congress.
Well, and this is where it gets complicated because yes, I'm agreeing with everything you said, but we have decades of we have ignored the laws in our land for decades. So we have decades and decades of ignoring the laws that we have had in place.
Or abusing them in a variety of ways.
In a variety of ways. Yes, and on both sides of the aisle and blah blah blah. So yes, and this is an extraordinary situation. It's not
it's a humanitarian crisis. It's
not to the degree that Europe faced in our very very recent past.
Yeah,
1,000 or 2,000 people is nothing compared to the millions that streamed into Europe seeking refuge.
Well, yeah, over a period of time. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes. So So we still have laws that we need to take some kind of action to deal with a situation then that's going on, we still need to be working within the context and spirit of the laws that are currently in place.
Right. If we need better staffing to deal with the processing the claims, then we need to work on getting that dealt with.
Right. Or we need to come up with a way of if we are truly going to take a position as a country where we're not going to encourage immigration to our country, then we just need to state that and we just need to make that happen.
But to be clear, this isn't an immigration issue. This is a refugee issue.
Yes, but
I mean, asylum seekers.
They're asylum seekers, but they are still immigrating. They are still coming to our country, and they are non-citizens.
Yes.
So
that is
if we are
that,
not
isn't
going
that what
to accept, if we're not going to accept refugees, or we're not going to accept asylum seekers, then we need to say that lawfully. So
and not try to create the practice of not accepting any refugees through
making through it really difficult.
Different practices under the same law.
Yes. Again, the problem is that we have been abusing. So we're using two different terms here, but the. But in general, what people are worked up about is illegal immigration.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of people who have immigrated to our country illegally. And for us to continue to ignore that is silly. It's not going to go away.
Right. So, but none of this posturing about a particular group of refugees or migrants or whatever is going to change the fact that our legal situation and our implementation of our legal situation has been messed up for a long time.
Right. So what is going on right now, and it's going on, and this is what I'm trying to play the middle of the road here a little bit, because what I feel like is happening is both parties are using this caravan for political advantage rather than truly dealing with humans and the challenges of each individual human story that are going on.
Well, at this point, we're not having any kind of a conversation about justice.
No.
And human needs. We're having two different conversations on two different sides of some weird, semi-artificial political divide in one particular nation and ignoring the universal call for justice or universal truths that are in play here.
Because there's been a breakdown on our value system, which is I can arbitrarily break the law when I want to.
But you can't.
No, I can.
But then you can.
But I can. Yeah. So, and that's how we have treated that. And when I say we, I mean that's how politicians have treated it.
Right.
That's how employers have treated it. That's how immigrants have treated it. Everybody's treated the laws that are related to crossing our border with a certain amount of willy-nilly flexibility, grays, and lawsuits, and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
So that I realize it's not as simple as just obey the law, but I had a great professor in college who she taught economics, and she said the demise of a democratic republic begins when the ability to own private property for the individual man fails, and when the rule of law fails. If individuals can no longer secure private property, and if individuals can no longer trust the judicial system to bring about justice, and I would say in general, we don't see just behavior when it comes to the issue of immigration, that we have people who try to immigrate legally for decades and can't. And then we have people who move here illegally and then are allowed to immigrate because their family is here or for whatever reason. There is injustice built into our system.
And part of the injustice built into our system is that we have set it up so that it is almost impossible to immigrate legally.
Yes.
And the quotas are so small
and
the standards are so stringent that there is no practical way for people to immigrate to our country.
Right.
And yet we have an economic system that demands a regular influx of new labor.
Well,
And so we're partly sustained by this new labor, but we don't give it that was very dehumanizing. We don't give them a legal route to citizenship or legal status in our country.
Right. Yes, agreed on all those points, and then I feel like I'm also coming off a little bit like I'm anti-immigration. I am way pro-immigration. I think we should make immigration easy to the United States, but I also think there should be expectations on immigrants in our country. So this is an unpopular position, but this is my position on this. If you come to America, you should speak English. I don't care if you speak Spanish too, but I moved to Thailand. I had to learn Thai to interact with Thai people. That's what, if I wanted to move to Thailand, I should learn to, like, just to be a good communicator within the context of the country. I'm not saying you have to do it within a year, but there are people who move to our country who never plan on learning the language. And that might be appropriate in some context, but it's very difficult to interact in our commerce and not speak the language. So I think let's open up and make it accessible for people to immigrate here. And let's go ahead and put some stipulations on it and say, you got to be a productive member of society. You need to speak the language. You need to have, but we're turning away people who are educated.
It would be great.
Yes. Yeah. Yes, both from our southern border and from either side of the ocean on either side of our country, and it's ludicrous.
You say that wouldn't be a popular position, but I think we probably entirely agree. I mean, I would go ahead and state even further. I think that we should have. I think we as a nation, as a very wealthy nation, have a moral obligation to also be welcoming to people who are in need.
I mean, it would be an unpopular opinion that the mandating of English.
Oh,
it would also be
well, and I would go even further and say, I mean, I think learning English or working on learning English should be a part of it for sure. But I think enculturation into American culture is an important part of that equation as well.
I figure YouTube's doing that anyway, so we're good there.
Everybody's already been exposed to McDonald's and Coca-Cola.
I've told you this. YouTube, the first day we moved to Thailand, I was in our home and I heard one of the teenage girls in the dormitory that was just across the way start singing Katy Perry's Roar. And I thought I could get away from this. Like, how did
I moved across the world to get away from Katy Perry.
To get away from Katy Perry, and here she is. So no, I totally agree. I think yes.
But you can't. I'm not anti-immigration
at all. Right. I am very pro-immigration, and I am very pro vetting the immigrants that are coming to our country from a security standpoint, and also from a standpoint of saying, look.
So that's great. That's great. I think
we're all very reasonable people.
Yes, we're all very reasonable people.
We need to Donnybrook about something.
I know. So I think that's a good. That's perfect. I agree. What should we do about this specific situation? Should the military be sent down to the border to turn them away?
I think we should have a midterm election. Is what I think we
right
should have.
Right smack the day that maybe, they get to the border.
Maybe the commander in chief should talk about renouncing the 14th Amendment, just to rally support for his base.
Oh, good grief. Oh my goodness!
And maybe George Soros is paying all those immigrants to come up from.
Yeah.
I really, I feel a little out of the loop here. I'd heard about the caravan, but
it's like
getting off of social media has kind of disconnected me a little bit from the news cycle. So I didn't know anything about renouncing an amendment.
Oh, yeah. The president said the other day that he thinks maybe we should get rid of the birthright citizenship.
Oh, that's lovely.
Yeah. With executive order.
So
we're going to overrule one law legally put in place.
An amendment.
Well, he's doing this with an executive order. That's not going to fly.
Well, you say
using it for political gain.
Right.
The exactly. language is being used.
He's just using
that's
it.
A language again.
We
he's
are.
Just using it to whip up the base during right. these midterm
elections.
Well, but this is the thing that actually, so I think John's right. What do we practically do right now? We as a nation meet the refugees at the border and process them according to our existing laws. And treat them according to our existing.
So practically, according to existing laws and policy, that means turning them away because they didn't go through it in the right channels. Which,
what do you mean turning them away? Like
saying
refusing
no.
their appeal for, like, you can show up at the border and request asylum.
There's a process for how you correctly request asylum, though.
I think technically,
and they somehow all those people have violated that process.
I think I remember reading that when
already
that technically, yeah, you can actually just show up and say, I need asylum, and they're supposed to process your case.
Yeah.
But they don't have enough caseworkers to do it. And so,
yeah.
how are they going to do like don't I think they have to do like background checks and stuff and
right which sounds like a big bureaucratic mess. Mm-hmm. But I mean, and I'm just guessing here that maybe the crisis will fizzle out after the election. First Tuesday in November. I'm just guessing.
Yeah, just wondering.
But like
now you're sounding like a right wing conspiracist.
You know what? I grew up in the right wing conspiracy world, so maybe it's just coming out now.
Well, I think it is interesting the timing on all of this from both directions.
They're supposed to be like they should be here like on Tuesday, right? Like
seriously,
like right before Tuesday, yeah. Like they're like and, walking up through Mexico,
and
right
we've
now.
Had a shooting at a synagogue, and we've had mail bombs.
Yeah. Yep.
So we're not talking about, you know, the potential demise of a democratic republic. We are watching it.
Well, I think
that might be a little bit of hyperbole.
No,
but
I mean,
think
it is.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I think we're gonna. It's gonna stick around at least for the rest of our. We're not going to see the end.
Like the way it was in the Roman Republic, where it kind of was gone, but kind of there in name only, sort of.
Well, actually, not to get all historical on you, but
I am.
a lot of the so at the end of the Republic. A lot of the Republican institutions survived, yes, in name, long after their real power was gone. And then at the end of the Roman Empire, which was quite a while later, the institutions survived long after the name had gone.
Yes.
So I think that we're probably seeing the demise of the institutions, while we'll probably retain the name of president and senate and
an empire.
Judiciary. Long after, you know, well, justice is fading.
Yeah.
Blah. Yeah, yeah.
That's all depressing.
So my concern right now with the executive branch is that we're moving, and I think this, I want to give credit where it's due. Is this Dan Carlin who says that we're moving to 4 and 8 year kingships,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where we're electing essentially a king who operates
because
through
the escalation of the executive power.
Of the executive power, which we've mm-hmm. seen consecutively from Clinton to Bush to Clinton to Bush to Obama to now to Trump.
Just looking at the stats, the number of executive orders, been a steady increase.
It's been a steady increase, and the breadth of those decisions is widening. So we're moving out of true Republican representation, and we're moving more to an whatever it is, a 4 or 8 year
we're losing a clear division of powers.
Kingdom, kingship.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You're picking your king.
Well, according to Aristotle, kingship is the good version of monarchical rule. Tyranny is what we're kingship is that has a lot of positive connotations mm-hmm. in political philosophy because it's wrapped up in the idea of someone actually serving their people.
Yeah.
So I
servant
think tyranny
leadership
is
through
the
king.
Right. I think tyranny is the right way to describe it.
And I don't think we've seen necessarily tyrants yet because I'm not entirely sure that I'm not willing to quite say that Clinton and Bush and Obama administrations were out purely to
for actual tyrants,
to just pad their own pockets.
Although, and the classic assessment of the devolution of a democracy is not into a tyranny, but it's into a mob rule. And so that the mob rule comes first, and then the tyranny comes in and replaces it. Because of the chaos of it. So,
and I don't think we haven't fallen into chaos yet.
Which what is so interesting though about the information age that we live in mm-hmm. is the power of money to buy mob rule, and the power of money and influence to affect what people think on such a wide scale.
And I do think that we are seeing new things in human history with the pervasiveness of information, but money has bought the mob throughout human history. Now, we definitely have a deeper saturation of information than ever before, but money has always been able to whip up the mob through the various mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I feel really depressed right now about the end of civilization. And we probably need to wrap things up at some point, but can we talk a little bit about anything good and hopeful before we move on? Have you been reading anything worthwhile lately?
Oh my goodness.
Give us your 3-minute spiel on what you're doing with Twitter right now.
Okay.
Don't tell us what you're reading. Yes. Tell us that. This is fun.
You're doing something with Twitter?
I'm going to do something
with positive.
This is important.
I thought about finding every Russian troll.
What could I do?
And sending them personal Merry Christmas cards.
I realized that my love language is white elephant gifts.
Oh my goodness.
This is how I love. And I decided that this year what I'm going to do is I'm going to come up with 25 or maybe 30 of the best white elephant gifts that I can find.
Okay.
And post one on Twitter every day. I'm going to set up a Twitter feed and I'm going to post one every day throughout November, December, you know, as we get up toward Christmas. So people can use this to go find the best white elephant gifts for their white elephant parties.
Is that decoration from our Christmas parties gonna, the Santa?
Well, these are actually things that you can buy.
Oh, okay. So you're not going to be like thrift store finds. It's going to be actual Amazon.
Actual Amazon.
But I think you're using some things that we've seen.
Yes.
So didn't you? You're using a calendar, I know.
Yep. So just a little teaser. I'm going to use the 2019 Putin calendar.
Oh, I like it. Okay.
So that'll be good.
We have seen that appear at a Christmas party before. Wouldn't that be wonderful
to open that up and get that in your white elephant party? Shirtless Putin on the back.
Fishing or something like that. Yeah, right. Playing polo.
Jiu-jitsu.
Oh, my goodness.
There's some pretty fantastic.
So what is the Twitter handle? Go ahead and promote here.
I think it's called White Elephant Helper. White Elephant Helper.
At White Elephant Helper.
I think it's at White Elephant Helper.
Yeah, you can't get all that into one Twitter handle.
Right, it's got to be shortened. I had to skip some vowels in there to get it all to work right. But you look for White Elephant Help and you'll find
it. We'll search it.
Yeah, it's going to be pretty good. Another just little.
What does it start? Black Friday?
I found, it's going to start on Black Friday. I found some hander pants.
Oh, and
they are gloves, fingerless gloves that look like underpants.
Oh my goodness. Like tidy whities?
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
That is awesome.
Oh yeah.
Are there any in-house rules to get, like, you're keeping all these things, I imagine, under $20 or something?
Yep. Okay. It's all going to be under $20. You can buy it all at Amazon. Uh-huh. So you can just click a link and buy it just like that.
Oh.
It'll be under $20. It'll be, and there's nothing that's like too like
obscene
or
Handerpants is as far as we go.
Handerpants is as far as it's going to go. Okay. You know, I looked at some of these lists. I tried to really find stuff from kind of organically rather than going to white elephant lists and sort of stealing clever ones from there. So I tried to find a lot of these organically. What's funny? Sharks are funny. Yes, they are. Sharks are just objectively funny. So sharks might make an appearance. Might make an appearance.
I don't know why sharks are funny. Platypus are funny.
That's true.
Yep. Yep.
Yeah. Alligators. Baboons.
The baboons, very
German
funny.
Accents are funny.
German accents are hilarious. You know what else would be really funny? Little rubber hands.
Oh, you don't give it all away. Don't give it all away.
Stick on the end of your hand, on the end of each
next
finger.
Next podcast, you have to tell us two more teasers. How about
that?
Okay.
That would be great.
Amanda, what about you? What if you are asking a question about us reading, I'm assuming that means you have read something good.
Well, I never finish books or do any reading at all.
Oh, come on. Just go.
But,
go.
I read a really great book this weekend called... oh boy, I can't remember. Life on the Dangers of Christian Practice by Lauren Winner.
Okay.
And so the subtitle's on Wayward Gifts, Characteristic Damage, and Sin. And so I won't try to summarize the whole book, but her thesis is that our consideration of practices within the church has to take into account the fact that the practices themselves inhabit the fallen world. And so when we're talking about what we do as Christians, we tend to talk about Christian practices as though they are pristine and undamaged things, and that any problems that occur within them occur because of the sin located in the individual.
So Christian practices mean like fasting or communion or prayer?
Yes. Baptism. So her three examples were Eucharist, prayer, and baptism. And so she explores some historical examples. I'll just mention the prayer one because I think it's probably the most compelling, although, well, I don't know. The other two are really interesting too. She says that our account of prayer has to consider the fact that there were Christian slave-owning women praying for the fortitude to properly beat their slaves. And so our understanding of prayer and our teaching about prayer has to take into account our characteristic ability or willingness to pray for evil things. And we can't understand who we are and what we are as Christians without taking that into consideration.
I've often wrestled with this when you look at like World War I and World War II diaries of folks on both sides of a battlefield writing on the same day for God to give them victory, grant them victory and safety.
Yes.
And they go out and blow each other's brains out.
Yep.
And this is why it makes the American Civil War so difficult for me to study.
Right.
Because I feel the tension at such a deep level. It hurts.
Well, so her chapter on prayer includes extensive excerpts from this one particular woman's diaries, where her prayer journal, where she journals about how devious and terrible and ungrateful her slaves are, and how she prays that God will make sure that there aren't any slaves in the part of heaven that she's in, and that abolitionists will be kept out, and how terrible it is to have slaves in her life because of how they push her to be angry or force her to be angry with them because of their unwillingness to love her. It's very disturbing to read.
So just because we are participating in a Christian
practice
does not make it holy.
Well, just because it is a Christian practice does not mean that it does not have characteristic damage in it, because it exists in the fallen world as well. So basically what she's saying is that there is a deep tension in prayer, in that prayer is good insofar as we learn and do what God calls us to do, which is modeled for us in the Lord's Prayer. And we ask for things that are in God's will, but it is damaged and damaging when we use it wrongly. And that the very structure of prayer itself leaves it open to this kind of damage. So then when she writes about the Eucharist, she writes about there are a number of stories in the Middle Ages of allegations against Jewish people of attempting to desecrate the host, and Christian violence in response to these allegations. And so she writes about how there's this inherent tension in Christians as Gentiles partaking of the Eucharist, which is in some sense a Jewish body being used as a justification for violence against Jewish bodies. And then in baptism, she talks about the inherent tension of baptism as calling us out of our family structure while then also affirming us in it. And so baptism takes us out of our worldly status, where we live in class and family, and puts us into the family of God. But in another sense, it affirms us within that structure, because, you know, there are exhortations to the family to you know, when children are christened or whatever, to raise them in the fear and the admonition of the Lord. So there's an affirmation of the familial structure, but also a calling out of. And that inherent tension needs to be something that we deal with in our account of these practices.
So just so I understand, is she saying that we have to account for or recognize that these practices, just to engage in the practices, doesn't make the practices good? Or is she saying that the practices themselves are somehow tainted?
She says that the practices themselves are part of the fallen world. And so they're not pure and perfect in and of themselves. They're inhabiting tension in a broken world.
Okay. I don't know that I like the way that that's being said, mm-hmm. but I can appreciate what's being pointed out. So maybe I'd probably nuance that statement a little differently.
Well, and I think that the way we tend to think about it is we think about I'm sinful and therefore I'm going to do things imperfectly. And I think what she's trying to point out is that we're not the only broken things in creation.
Okay, so I'm going to just read this in contrast to what you just said, okay? And I don't know how this fits exactly, but...
I probably don't either, but...
Okay, so now the Spirit expressly says that in the latter times, there will be some who depart from the faith by devoting themselves to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the insincerity of liars whose consciences are seared, who forbid marriage and require abstinence from food that God created to be received with thanksgiving for those who believe and know the truth. So marriage and food are some of those things that I would say are maybe not Christian practices, but they're just institutions that right. are God created to be good.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
For everything created by God is good. And nothing is to be rejected if it is received with thanksgiving, for it is made holy by the word of God and prayer. So I think I'd have to read. I'm very curious. I'd like to read it because I think I realize that's not fair to just throw down a verse and be like, see, walk away, and there's my kill verse. I'm not trying to suggest that at all, but to suggest that the institution in and of itself.
So and
yes, I would be prone to be the first thing that you said. We're sinners, and so of course it's broken because I'm busted.
I may not be fully representing her position. Obviously, she's very smart and said things probably much better than I can. But I think one of the things that what she's pointing out is it's not just that I can do things badly, but that. Things are so broken that I will inevitably do things badly, and the nature of the world is that everything has within it every practice, even good practices, have within them a structural tendency to go badly in particular ways. Does that?
I want to read the book.
I want you to read the book. Okay, I think that you will really enjoy it.
No, it sounds very...
It really got me thinking a lot about... So in teaching, we talk a lot about different approaches to this, or we should be doing things this way, or we should be doing things that way. And always what comes up again and again and again is that no matter how well we try to teach, no matter how well we try to educate our students, anything that we emphasize in our teaching has an inherent way of going badly by having very high standards. We can be very legalistic, mm-hmm. or by trying to really emphasize grace in our community, we can become permissive. It's not just that I can screw things up individually. It's that no matter what I do, there are built-in tendencies to go wrong. Mm-hmm. And I think that just the way she framed it has gotten me thinking a lot more about holding loosely my goals and my ideals in my practices, both teaching and parenting and as a Christian, and thinking about the characteristic. Yeah. So her phrase, characteristic damage, was just so compelling for reassessing that.
I can totally see the benefit of that because we do have a tendency to find, like you and I especially are super strongly opinionated, and
really?
We're opinionated because we think we're right.
Oh,
we don't just
arrive
at those opinions because they're arbitrary.
No. I don't hold that opinion strongly just because I feel like it. I really think it's true.
Right, right. Or because I'm trying to be a redneck or I'm trying to be a... Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I'm trying to thoughtfully... Mm-hmm. But to recognize, yeah, you may have thoughtfully wandered right down the middle of a disaster and not recognized it.
Or I might thoughtfully have come to a very good opinion, but characteristic within the world is this... You know, this
tendency fatal towards bent, perfectionism, or tendency towards legalism, or tendency towards permissiveness. Yeah,
or using something, assuming that practices just because they're within the church then are pure, and I don't have to assess how I'm doing. Like, prayer is good. Nobody ever cautions you. Like, I can't remember ever hearing anybody caution me about being careful about how I pray. Prayer is good.
You should have been in more charismatic churches growing up.
Should I? Well, I did spend some time in one.
I think that I would enjoy talking with you guys for another hour.
But we got to wrap this up.
I think our listeners are probably ready for us to wrap this up.
And I'm actually ready to wend my way home and get some sleep. So
there we go. So anyway, this has been fun. John, do you have any styling tunes to lead us out? Styling tunes.
You are so cool.
Is that what the cool kids say?
No, I did. You just need to find. I heard Alabama Shakes the other day, and I think it was Hold On by Alabama Shakes, but it's got too long of an intro to do right now. So just find that and play that as the outro. Hold On by Alabama Shakes. It's a great, great rock song.
All right, I'll do that. Well, thanks for being here. This was fun. I'm David.
Amanda.
John.
We'll see you next time.